KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Autumn DeWilde has more than 20 years of experience photographing rock bands and directing commercials, but she'd never gotten to make a feature film. Then, out of the blue, a British production company asked her to pitch her ideas for a new version of the Jane Austen classic, Emma.
I mean, you said, yay, I want to do Emma. But did you say, well, why do you want to do Emma? Or did you just say, I'm happy, so I'm not going to ask?
I mean, I feel like you would never say that about Shakespeare.
That is true.
DeWilde says she didn't make Emma solely for Jane Austen superfans, like me, but Austenites will appreciate the way DeWilde obsessed over every period detail, even fighting for every tightly wound tiny ringlet on her title character's head. But first on the news banter, Hollywood encounters the coronavirus. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague in banter, Matt Bellany, the Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, Matt, obviously anxiety is high. The news about coronavirus is moving so fast. I feel like we are recording at this moment in time, and things could change within hours. They could change. And we are being counseled to be calm and wash our hands, and I think we should be. All of that is good. But what we see, of course, is that the entertainment business is in a very difficult position. It is being affected already dramatically. Billions of dollars are lost already and going to be lost. We can't even gauge it, but there are some difficult decisions to make, and some companies are extremely exposed. I mean, I will start with MGM. They just moved the Bond movie. The Bond movie is so important to MGM. It is the lifeblood of MGM, and the company has been, it is believed, looking to sell itself, and Bond was the bait on the hook. Unlike the last two, they had partners, financing partners. This is all MGM. A lot of money already spent on advertising. There was a Super Bowl ad. There are all kinds of partners, Heineken, Omega. What happens to that campaign? What happens to MGM? What the impact on the company is remains to be seen. I think one reason that MGM in particular wanted to move this movie is it is very reliant on overseas box office, and significant territories overseas, obviously, are impacted before this country, and it may come here too, but for this movie, those markets are absolutely critical.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, what you're seeing overseas is pretty shocking. I mean, all the theaters in China are closed. And even in countries where the theaters are open, we quoted someone this week saying basically they might as well not be. In South Korea this past weekend, the box office was down 80%. The box office in Italy is basically nothing. In Japan, basically nothing. I mean, this is the international market right now. And yes, it may come to the U.S. And this, we may be talking in a couple of weeks about how the U.S. theaters are closed. But if you have a movie like Bond or like Disney's upcoming Mulan or these big tentpole movies, you really got to think about whether it's better served to postpone it 6-8 months and hope for the best.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, the virus is already here, but not that kind of reaction at this point as we're speaking. We are seeing companies like Apple and Netflix pull out of South by Southwest and companies restricting travel, closing overseas offices, that sort of thing. We haven't seen people staying away from theaters in droves yet. And Mulan, you mentioned, is a movie that was certainly designed with the Chinese market in mind. That's a big problem for Disney, but it's only one of many big problems for Disney right now because it is so exposed in terms of its theme parks, hotels, movie theaters. This is really a huge challenge. They've got three of their overseas theme parks closed right now. And of course, the question will be, is that going to happen here?
Yeah, I mean, don't forget cruise ships. Disney is also in the cruise ship
yes,
business.
Of course.
And that is, you know, who's going to get on a cruise ship right now? Disney is the most interesting company to watch here because of how exposed it is to this. And I think because of the brand in Disney, and I've talked to some people within the studio who say that they are very conscious of the fact that whatever they do is going to send a signal to the world that the Walt Disney Company is either pulling their movies, closing their theme parks, that is going to have a ripple effect throughout the world. And they're very conscious of this. And I think that's why you haven't seen them move to close some of the U.S. parks yet, because what they're doing is they're saying we're adhering to what the CDC says, which is that you should keep acting normal, not canceling school or other gatherings, but be very conscious of what you're doing and adhere to all these sanitary procedures. When Disney moves to close these parks, then I think then we will say this has truly come to America and we really have to be afraid.
When or if, right? We don't know yet. But the trend doesn't seem so good. I'll just note, you know, Disney, as you know, certainly had an unbelievable year last year, 2019. Earlier on the day that we are recording, the stock was at 113. Just a couple of weeks ago, it was at 125. Before they started their incredible run, going all the way back to 2015, the stock was at 112. Now it's at, as of when I'm speaking, about 113. So the entire, since 2015, gigantic success of Disney in terms of how the market is valuing Disney stock has gone full circle.
Yeah, and a little bit of that might be due to the CEO change. I mean, they just announced Bob Chapek as CEO, and obviously this being dropped in his lap in his first month as CEO is a trial by fire for him. Ultimately, he's going to have to make that call as to whether to close parks and dock cruise ships and things like that. But it, you know, it feels a little morbid to talk about the business winners and losers of this global outbreak, but this is a business show. I think that you've got to think that Netflix and these streaming services that are launching in the next couple months are looking at this as a potential opportunity because they're going to have people quarantining themselves, not going out, not doing those trips that they've done in the past. The Netflix stock has actually been up recently. And I think that's a kind of weird side effect of what's going on in the world right now.
Yeah. So, this could have a lot of impact if it continues to roll. And nobody knows, you know, is it going to affect spring break? Is it going to affect Easter? Is it going to affect summer? We don't have a clue, but it could be transformative for this business in certain ways. I mean, the pressure to stream movies is going to go up. And that is not the model that you have in mind when you make a movie for a couple hundred million bucks. I don't think the analysis has been done that I know about how that would even work. You know, to me, I step back from all of this and I look at it and I think, there is this huge experiment going on with all of these big companies putting their marbles on streaming. And I don't know that we have true proof of concept because when Netflix did this, there was no competition. And now you're coming into a brutal field and it's a completely different game. And you're giving up revenue to get yourself established and you're spending to get yourself. We're looking at a point in the entertainment business that, you know, I've never seen anything like it, and neither has anybody else.
It'll be interesting to see if, given what's going on in the world, if a studio tries to do a day and date release where they put it on a streaming service the same day it's in theaters. They could blame the virus, but this is where the studios want to be going, and maybe they'll use this as an opportunity to experiment.
In an uncertain world, I think that's a fairly sure bet. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. The latest movie version of Jane Austen's Emma tells a story that's familiar if you've read the book or perhaps are a fan of Clueless, Amy Heckerling's 1995 update on the original.
Oh, as if!
In this retelling, Anya Taylor-Joy plays the title character, as ever, handsome, clever, and rich. Fancying herself a matchmaker, Emma turns her attention to Harriet, an undistinguished young woman of uncertain birth, who Emma sees as part friend, part project. Harriet is delighted to have received a marriage proposal from a fine young local farmer, but Emma insists she can find Harriet a better and wealthier match. Longtime family friend Mr. Knightley, played by Johnny Flynn, is appalled at Emma's meddling.
She's the natural daughter of nobody knows who.
She reckons scarcely
that
her father's gentleman and a gentleman
of fortune. Relation.
Her allowance is very liberal. Nothing has been grudged for her improvement.
She is known only as a parlour boarder at a common school. She is pretty and she is good-tempered.
And that is all.
That is all. These are not trivial recommendations, Mr. Knightley. Till men do fall in love with well-informed minds instead of handsome faces, a girl with such loveliness as Harriet has a certainty of being admired and sought after wherever she goes.
Emma is a first feature for filmmaker Autumn de Wilde, who spent years behind the camera, first as a rock photographer and then as a music video and commercial director. De Wilde had long hoped that one day she might direct a feature and leaped at the chance when producers at the British company Working Title Pictures approached her with the idea of making yet another version of Austen's classic early 19th century novel.
I got a call from my managers and said, would you want to have a call with Working Title and Blueprint Pictures about directing Emma, I almost dropped the phone. You know, I was like, I would.
Had you read Emma?
Yeah, I have to say now I feel like I didn't really digest it like I know it now. But that's what's great about her books is that I think you're really rewarded with her sense of humor when you do more research on what the old meanings of words are and the class system at that time and the social pressures and the etiquette. And
right. But did you sort of say to them, I mean, you said, yay, I want to do Emma. But did you say, well, why do you want to do Emma? Or did you just say, I'm happy, so I'm not going to ask?
I mean, I feel like you would never say that about Shakespeare. You know, I
that think, is true.
You know, I think a great story, obviously, like Jane Austen wrote and the way Shakespeare wrote, these stories can be translated in so many different ways because within the sort of historical context of the story is this perceptive pen pointing at human relationships and hubris and the glories and the failures of love and friendship.
This sounds bad, but it's not meant bad. But why you? You were never done a film. Mm-hmm. You definitely have done. I mean, you're talking to KCRW. So I think many people who are listening who are KCRW listeners know that you've done a lot of rock photography. And I've shot Beck, Jenny Lewis, Elliott Smith, the White Stripes. And that's amazing. I don't know if you ever shot at KCRW back in the day.
I did. I shot Spin recording live, and I feel like there was another couple times, yeah.
And you have shot commercials.
Yeah.
A lot.
I still direct commercials. I love them. I'm fascinated by marketing. It's not a punishment for me. I mean, really, rock and roll photography, a big part of doing that successfully is marketing, you know. And I think to answer the question about why me, I don't know, except that I had been over the years been approached. People periodically would say, I think you're a storyteller. It shows in your photography. It shows in your commercials and your music videos. But what I heard is that my Florence and the Machine Big God video came out, and someone at Working Title was really excited by it and then started looking into my work and realized they had my reel from my manager from a year before. I think I was submitted for something else. And she told me she was about to go to the higher ups at Working Title and said, we should really have a conversation with her. I don't know how that went from that to me directing Emma, except that I think initially they were planning to just have a conversation and using this as a reason to have a conversation. But I did come prepared to that conversation on the phone, and they liked what I had to say, which led to a meeting with the head of Working Title, one of the heads, Tim Bevan. And then I got, as soon as that conversation ended, I got an email, Tim would like you to pitch officially on the film. So
when you say you came prepared,
I had ideas
for generally just how to make a movie ideas.
I mean, I haven't made a movie, but I'm 49 and I've been
well, that's
making,
amazing too.
You know, I've been, you know, the thing is I'm not a 25-year-old doing my first film. I have 20 plus years of experience building a talented crew, knowing the people I need to make my vision come to life. I have found that experience plus 14 years of ballet plus drama school. I speak the language of actors. So I had a weird, wide, wiggly way of getting to this, my first film, but I definitely have a lot of experience. And perhaps, you know, perhaps if I was a man, maybe I would have been asked earlier, but I don't feel resentful about that because along the way, I just kept trying to make sure there was nothing anyone could catch me out on so that when I got my chance, I was 100% prepared. So
Emma was on the table when you went in to pitch Tim Bevan.
Yeah. So I was potentially going to officially be asked to pitch on Emma, but I had to have this conversation with Tim Bevan, and I did have ideas already. You know, what I said was that I would really like to humanize the story, not to modernize it. I find the class system so strange and interesting that I really, rather than shying away from the historical aspect of it, I wanted to find a way to explain that to viewers who don't understand the class system.
How did you decide to approach that?
Well, part of it is that there's a lot of storytelling that can be told with color, with hair, with costumes that tell you where someone's position is in society. You might not understand the finer details of the class system, but you understand in my movie, I hope, that Mrs. Elton is the nouveau riche. If you don't understand that, you know that she is a thorn in Emma's side. So I think there are things that we can connect to as humans that remind us of the power structure in an office, the hierarchy in high school. You know, there are these ways to explain where someone belongs in that ladder that aren't just using the words.
Best Mrs. Elton I've seen, by the way. Amazing. I mean, the cast is great, but she absolutely nails that thing so hard.
It was also really important, you know, that no one is spared the sword. So we are making fun of Mrs. Elton, but Emma gets made fun of. Mr. Knightley gets made fun of. The great thing about screwball comedy, which was also part of my pitch, was I'd like to employ American screwball comedy into the presentation of this film, because movies like Bringing Up Baby and His Girl Friday, the comedy comes from everyone being so square and things going wacky, or a person like Katharine Hepburn's character being a disruptor while everyone else is standing there following the rules. And so I felt that that was a great way of physicalizing the passive-aggressive behavior that all the characters are suffering or imposing on other people.
So you actually sent a physical thing to the, I don't know how many executives to the group. I don't explain how that worked.
Yeah. So I decided to make a tactile pitch, one that couldn't be sent via the internet. So that meant I had to make two because it was going to be a Skype pitch initially. So I printed these really beautiful, they're almost like postcard size cards with my film inspiration, lighting inspiration, fashion history, caricatures, which I got a lot of ideas from the cartoonists that were poking fun at fashion and society and the powerful. And they were wrapped in newsprint because I thought I should use some kind of paper that was used then. And I thought it was interesting to think about how newspapers existed then and they exist now. And so I had the first page of Emma printed on a large piece of newsprint and wrapped the cards in that and a silk ribbon, and they were sent off to London. And so when it was time to sit down and do my Skype call, I had a package and they had a package and they had to unwrap it. And then what they did was I told them, you know, you're going to have to ask you stand up in order to see it, but if you could just spread them out at random across the table. And I think that what happened was that they could see a bird's eye view of the film. All the colors sort of created this collage impression of the type of movie I was going to make.
Pastels. Light and bright.
Yes, the Georgian colors. Color was how you showed your wealth. And so this was also a big part of my pitch, is we've grown accustomed to movies that look like everything is 200 years old in the movie. And it's not as vintage to them, you know. And so this was a great opportunity to do a movie that could employ the colors that are historically accurate but are not seen often in films. And it was a way, I think, of identifying itself differently.
Coming up after a short break, Emma director Autumn DeWilde tells us about the hidden musical jokes in Emma's not-so-pitch-perfect pianoforte performance. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? Critics rave The Greatest Hits is a music-infused romance that hits all the right notes and the most original time travel story in years. Featuring music by Nelly Furtado, Beach House, Jamie XX, and more. Watch The Greatest Hits, now streaming on Hulu.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Autumn DeWilde, director of the newest version of the Jane Austen classic, Emma, which is in theaters now. Fans of Austen's comedy of manners will note DeWilde's period-specific details and the script's frequent use of dialogue lifted directly from Austen. DeWilde says she wasn't intimidated by the obsessive nature of certain Austen devotees, even though they take these things seriously.
When Joe Wright made Pride and Prejudice, I was very interested in that as a lover of Jane Austen. Mm-hmm. And I had this clever idea to, they were screening the movie at the annual meeting of the Jane Austen Society of North America. I don't think it had opened yet. And so I was at NPR, we sent a person to this screening. And we ask people coming out, who these Jane Austen freaks, uh-huh. and I'm leading to a question of this fandom. Like, is there a toxic Jane Austen fandom? I don't know. But we're going to play you a little sample of what some of the reaction was.
I didn't like the fact, and I never like this when it happens, that the writers decided to drop Jane Austen's dialogue. No one wrote better dialogue than Jane Austen, and substitute their own extremely lame and often out-of-period dialogue.
The Bennets are landed gentry, and I thought the attempt to make it quote-unquote realistic made their social status too downscale. You know, they wouldn't have had the pigs quite so close to the house.
Throughout the entire movie, whether they were at the ball or first thing up in the morning, in dishabille in their family boudoir, or whatever they might be, their hair was a mess.
So I thought that was hilarious. I mean, I agreed with much of what they said. And there was, I will say, just to be fair, there was a guy who said, I think it's fine. It's a living form and you can interpret it. And that's the deal. So that was represented in the story. Just want to be clear. But let me just say that Joe Wright did not take well to this criticism, and we're just going to play you his reaction.
They can, I don't know, go and jump in a lake. I don't know. I'm not really that interested in quibblers like that. I didn't make the film for them. I made it for myself, really.
And his publicist said I would never, ever be allowed to interview anybody from the studio again, which I think was the same studio that released this film, so yeah. Wrong. But but what I am asking is, it feels to me, even down to the hair, which I know was of particular interest to you, that you avoided all of those pitfalls because you stayed true to the material.
I mean, the first thing that I have to say is that I don't believe in fear-based creation. So I would not ever make these decisions because I'm afraid of what the fans might say. I didn't do that in Rock Photography, and I didn't do that in advertising, and I don't do that now.
Well, to be honest, I thought he would laugh, but he did not laugh.
Well, because I'm sure it felt like a personal attack. But I do believe that the story holds up no matter how you want to interpret it.
As we saw with Clueless.
In that movie, yes, and I love Clueless so much. And I think Pride and Prejudice brought so much joy to so many people. And, you know, I have a personal obsession with the details. And I agree with him. I made this movie for myself. And I know where I broke the rules. And there are some people that will upset. And I think that's okay because, like I said, I don't think that there's ever too many versions of this. I think that each person who makes a Jane Austen film should be bringing the story forward the way that the story has moved them. And for me, I have an obsession with the hairstyles and the class system in general. And I know a lot more than is obvious in the film. I also exaggerate a little and I heighten the world a little. I brought a lot of private moments into the story that no one can debate what someone does in private in any time period.
Right.
And that was the fun of it, you know, for me. So what I love about the Jane Austen fans is that they're insatiable.
That, they are.
And yeah. We're lucky because that means if you make a film, whether they like it or not, a lot of times they'll go to watch it. And that means that these movies can still be made because it's a guaranteed audience. Now, what I hoped was that by humanizing the story, I hope that I bring in more than just the Jane Austen fans, because I do think, like, to create a true escape film where you can time travel and get away from life for 2 hours is not an easy task. And I think that a romantic comedy also appears to be a simple task, but I think it's one of the most challenging things to do because the setup is you sort of know it's going to end happily. And if you kind of know the ending, how do you keep someone interested along the way? And I think that the way through that is that we have so many unresolved feelings about these basic human issues. Ben Gibbard, the lead singer of Death Cab for Cutie, told me once, he's like, I'm not sure what I was so upset about in my 20s, but I remember every single person that hurt my feelings in high school. And I thought about that a lot while I was making this. I was like, these are iconic relationships that she wrote about that we've seen in cop shows, we've seen in other movies, When Harry Met Sally, you know.
This is what so many people, I think, fail to get about Jane Austen. They think it's about doilies and tea service.
I know.
And it's so about everything. And it's frustrating when you hear people dismiss it that way.
It is. And I also, you know, some Jane Austen fans will be distressed that there's an undressing scene. But for me, I thought, I've seen all these movies and I haven't seen what the process of a man getting dressed in the early 19th century.
I was not ready to see Mr. Knightley's butt, but I was okay. I went with it.
And I just thought, you know, he is the moral compass. He's going to boss Emma around a lot. And I thought it was really interesting to see him in a vulnerable position first. Secondly, I didn't know until I had my education on the way a man was dressed that they basically wear the same things. Men and women wore nightgowns under their clothes. They didn't wear underwear yet, and they both had stockings put up over their knees. They both got dressed by servants. It was complicated to do it on your own. All of this was really interesting to me, and so I wanted to put that in the film.
I love the scene where Emma plays the, it's not the piano, it's
pianoforte.
Like pianoforte, and you really convey that she's not very good at it. And she's so used to being petted and flattered that she's expecting everybody to say that was great. And then along comes Jane and she's, yes.
Emma, as you probably know, is the first novel, apparently, to go inside the head of the main character and outside the main character's point of view. And so because of that, there's a lot of potential misunderstandings for the descriptions of the characters. You really don't know if, you know, when she describes Jane Fairfax as boring, if she really is, or if that's just the mean girl at high school who's jealous, who has decided that her best attack is to call her boring. And so we had a lot of fun with Jane Fairfax's secret and with Amber Anderson and with Anya Taylor-Joy. Well, let's make a real rivalry here. And both of them are experts at hiding it. And as dark as some of Emma's behavior is, I wanted Jane to be guilty of being a young girl who's competitive as well. And so that piano battle between them is really funny. And there's some musical jokes in there just for musicians. Like, I asked Anya to take too long to extend a note in a non-musical way towards the end of the song so that Jane Fairfax's character gives her a look like, are you kidding me? You know, like, this is ridiculous. Why does everyone think she's any good at all? You know,
right.
And so I wanted it to be more teenager.
Right, like, taking the language of looks and manners and making it the language of musical notes.
Yeah, and when, you know, the way people fight against the rules in their clever and crafty way is great comedy to me as well.
I mean, the hair, I know, was important. One of your casts had some expression for it.
Yeah. We had Curl Gate and Bonnet Gate. Be like, Curl keeps getting caught on the, you know, she had this, especially when she wore these coral earrings, her curls kept getting caught. So my crew started calling it Curl Gate. I'd be like, stop. Okay. And I'm like, fix the curl. Go back. Okay. No, curl's fuzzy now. Because we had really specific times when Emma's hair needs to look like it's out of control. And part of her hair story was, I mean, it was very elaborate process, these tiny little curls that were done with irons. They did have hair pieces as well that were made with real hair. And it was a process. It wasn't something she could have done herself. She had to have a maid who did it. And so as the movie goes on and Emma's becoming more human and her emotions are getting the better of her, I wanted to see it in her hair. So by the time we get to the passive-aggressive card game, her hair's fuzzy and the curl's a little bit drooped. And all of this was Maurice Langan, our hair makeup designer. This was very thoughtfully planned out because of my request. And it also shows Emma's maturity. She really starts out kind of like a little doll with all the curls at the front, and slowly the curls start moving back. And there's this maturity you start to see in her hair, in her look.
The language of hair.
Yeah.
So what's next? Do you want to, you're all about the movies now? Or are you saying, give me another music video or a commercial?
I'm in love. I will continue. At this point, I choose probably one music video a year that I really believe in. And commercials, I really love. So I'll continue with that, but I'm in love with making movies and I can't wait to start another one.
Do you know which one it'll be?
I can't tell you.
That's a secret. Autumn DeWilde is the director of Emma. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And that's the business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program, and Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.